This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Our email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. It's a pleasure to talk once again with the former chancellor of Louisiana State University, Mike Martin, who has devoted his career to academia. For the last 4 years, he has been president of Florida Gulf Coast University, and he is here to talk about then and now, and it's always a pleasure to catch up with you, Dr. Martin.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's good to hear the mellifluous voice of Jim Inkster. I haven't heard it for a while, so good to talk to you.
Well, I sure miss you. You were, in my view, a good chancellor, but you said some things that others have not, that probably thought the same as you, and one of those is that LSU is the most political place on the planet.
Well, it certainly has. It's a unique political spin, that's for sure. It was a challenge, but also perpetually interesting. So if nothing else, every day was an adventure at LSU.
Well, before we get to the matters at hand, you have served in high places and academia all over the country and all parts of the country. Have you ever seen a place like LSU?
Well, Louisiana itself, as you know, Jim, is a unique place. That's part of both the fascination and occasionally the frustration. And I've never been in a place that's been quite that intensely engaged in the political world. And I think part of it has to do that the campus is, what, about a strong 7-iron from the Capitol. So it was pretty easy for people to wade in from time to time. But it made it part of the challenge, and occasionally it made it a little bit challenging. But I've never been in any place quite like Louisiana, but that's what I loved about it in so many ways, and also what frustrated all of us in some ways as well.
And athletics, particularly football, is front and center at LSU.
No question. Now, I did have the advantage of having spent 6 years as a senior VP at Florida, so I had a pretty good sense of the power of SEC-level football when I got to LSU. So that gave me, I think, an advantage over some because, you know, you've been talking a lot about Les Miles. I also had plenty of opportunity to cross paths with Steve Spurrier and folks like that. So I wasn't maybe naive as some others when I arrived and understood the power of that particular program.
You were there at LSU, or here, if we might put it, since we're not too far either, 2008 to 2012, and those were relatively good years coming off a national championship season in 2007. But Les Miles was the coach, and Steve Spurrier, as we know, is a far from perfect man, as most of us are. But one thing he said as coach at both Florida and South Carolina and at Duke prior to being at Florida was that if a player hit a woman, that he was off the team. That's it. That's the one unforgivable sin for Coach Spurrier. Well, at LSU, we found out that was not an unforgivable sin.
Yeah, that's a really sad report that I've read of late about the conduct of some players. And you're right about Steve. I think Steve, as I recall, his father was a minister, and he came from a fairly deep religious background as well as a football background. But in any case, he did have some pretty clear standards, and we knew that, all of us who had a chance to interact with him. And, you know, to some extent, I expected that to be the case with Les as well, but I guess recent reports suggest that some of us missed signs we probably should have in both Les's management of the team and the conduct of some of the people he recruited.
It is in the Hush Blackwell report that Les Miles preferred to have blondes with ample cleavage in his office. He reached a settlement with a person who accused him of sexual misconduct. There were multiple complaints about his actions. Did you know any of this?
I didn't know that. I mean, I think you know we've talked about this. I had a few other head-on collisions with Les over various things, but that's not what I heard. And if Joe Oliva known it, I think Joe would have absolutely shared it with me, and we would have addressed it. You know, Les had this capacity to disguise himself a little bit with his what might be referred to as a goofy exterior. And I think now that goofy exterior probably disguised conduct that none of us saw right away, but obviously has been revealed since.
You said you did have some collisions with him. What were they related to?
Well, one big collision was when another university tried to hire Joe Oliva away, and after consulting with a number of people on the topic very quickly, I concluded that it was in our best interest to keep Joe, and Les was very angry about that and ran me to try to undermine the decision to retain Joe. And he and I had a pretty intense conversation off campus with a third party in the room, in which I explained to Les that if an assistant coach end ran him to the AD, he would not take it well. And him end running me to both the board and some other influential people did not sit very well with me either. Then there was the major violation that we had with the NCAA, in which we self-reported and self-imposed before we went before the Committee on Infractions. We imposed some pretty stiff penalties on ourselves. And Les was not happy at all about that and about the decision to fire the assistant coach who had perpetrated the violations. And in both instances, he did not take that well. But Joe and I stuck to our guns, and in the end, if you can go back and read, I think there's a newspaper article mm-hmm. about it, maybe more than one, that the NCAA congratulated us for the way we handled it, and after we finished with the Committee on Infractions, they imposed no more penalties because they thought we had been honorable in the way we managed it. But Les was none too happy about that. And then I think you've also reported, or others have reported, he had this perpetual desire to build his own dining hall. And I rejected that continually, and he continually came in with convoluted arguments about why it was absolutely essential. But the principal argument that I heard from him every time is, Nick has one. And so the argument was, well, if Saban has one, I must need one as well. And so we had those moments, but that's what you get with kind of the big-time, big-name coach. He's going to exercise as much influence as he can, and you have to be pretty resolute in resisting it.
Well, when he said his own dining hall, he meant independent of other athletic teams, or what did he mean by that?
Well, he wanted to have a dining hall in the football ops building. I don't know if they would have invited other sports teams in, but he clearly wanted it. I think he has one now called his nutrition center. But for me, it was just another dining hall on the other side of Nicholson Avenue. It just didn't make any sense to me at the time. Now, everybody has their own view of the world, but I thought it was awfully expensive given the fact that we had significant deferred maintenance on academic buildings that should have been first on the list for any kind of improvement. And second, I always believe that student athletes, at least at the very minimum, ought to dine occasionally with their peers. And so he and I had that conversation continually. But it's just what happened. Every year he came in with his spiel. And, you know, as I've said, I think I said this to his face one day after he left my office, or he leave my office, I said, the problem with your arguments, Les, is your sentences rarely turn into paragraphs. I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're talking about. I mean, I wasn't trying to be offensive, but, you know, he'd get on these spiels, and when you're all done, you kind of had a headache, but you didn't gain much from it. But that comes with the territory. I knew that going in. And so I was as prepared for it as any. And, you know, because of that, I had some advantages, and I'm not trying to excuse anybody here, but I had some advantages over King Alexander. One of the things I did going in, and people could probably research this, when I took the job, I negotiated a pretty comfortable retreat strategy if I had to go back to the faculty. And so I always knew that worst comes to worst, I would be a very well-paid faculty member in the Manship School, incidentally. And so I always felt that I had a fallback personally and professionally. And then I had the great benefit of having a number of people I could turn to for advice and counsel, one of whom was Mike Slive, who I think to this day is one of the greatest commissioners in college sports, and I had John Lombardi as a buffer in many cases, and John had his own challenges in dealing with him and others, but I could count on John if I really needed him to be a bit of a shield if things got really tough. So I had some advantages, and I took advantage of what I knew, and it helped me, I think, keep from pulling out what was left of my hair when I arrived at LSU.
Well, John Lombardi was president. At that time, the jobs were split, and we'll get to whether it's a good idea to have a combined president and chancellor with Mike Martin, who served as chancellor for just over 4 years at LSU during the Les Miles era, during the Bobby Jindal era. Jindal and he basically came in at the same time in 2008. And at one point, Miles was offered, presumably, the job at the University of Arkansas, and Governor Jindal intervened, didn't he?
Yep. And there were also continuing rumors that he was going to go to Michigan. I think this may never happen, but someone, I think, spotted the plane owned by the guy who founded Domino's, Monahan, yep, at the airport, and the assumption was that he was there to fly Les to Michigan for the job. And I'm never sure if that was true or if that was just some really well-managed piece of information from his agent. But we resisted the temptation to overreact to that. He did kind of come up with a modest adjustment to his contract. But I was never entirely sure how legit, and I think it's played all the time. I mean, even I will confess as an academic.
Okay, we do have to take a break, but we'll be back in 90 seconds with Mike Martin. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing, and we're continuing our visit with Dr. Mike Martin, the president of Florida Gulf Coast University. He was at LSU from 2008 to 2012, then went off to Colorado State. And for the last 4 years, he's been in the Sunshine State, and he is regarded as one of the real superstars in higher education, and has survived in an environment that is difficult in any place, but especially at Louisiana State University. And he left with his dignity, and some people, as we know, at LSU do not. And that's what we're talking about. There is a huge scandal right now. The president and chancellor's job is open. The football team has a coach that is under fire. The basketball program is under NCAA investigation. And the baseball program, which has been the shining light, is 1-8 in the Southeastern Conference. So times are tough, and quite often we judge LSU by the success or lack thereof of athletic teams, and that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is at Tigertown. And Mike Martin got in the middle of that without desiring to, and had the governor of Louisiana interceding on behalf of Les Miles. How often did you hear from Governor Bobby Jindal during those years?
I only heard directly from the governor maybe two or three times, and then I heard from his chief of staff, first Timmy and then later Stephen Wagesback, with a little more regularity. And then there was at least one member of the board who would characterize himself as speaking on behalf of the governor when they needed to intercede. But by and large, you know, the direct stuff was maybe two or three times. Clearly on the decision about keeping Joe Oliva, the governor called me directly and told me he thought that it was best to let him go because Les preferred it. And my argument is the last thing you want to do is have a football coach picking his own boss. It seems to me that's really a recipe for disaster. So whatever else I thought it would be a very bad precedent to let the football coach be dictating the terms of who is going to run the overall athletic department.
And what were the other times the governor
I think he did call me on the. I'm pretty sure he called me directly on the NCAA violations and our desire to fire the assistant coach, whose name was J.D. McCarthy, I think was his name, and the penalties we imposed up front before the NCAA even heard from us. But in each of those instances, it really struck me as the right thing to do. And, you know, after one call, I didn't hear again, and I took that to be okay. And I had made sure I consulted with a couple members of the board, with John Lombardi, with Mike Slive, and a few others, so that I felt I had some air cover beyond just my own role.
Now, the sexual misconduct allegations are not unique to the football program. They have been campus-wide, particularly among the fraternity system. Did you have issues on other parts of campus in that realm during your time?
Yes, we did, and we took them head-on at the time, and you always had a bit of that. I mean, unfortunately, you get close to 30,000 young folks in particular, and it only takes a tiny, tiny fraction to step over the line before you have a very serious concern. And we had a few there. We had some challenges with fraternities and some conduct in that regard as well. And I think in every instance, as people stepped up, there was a really good internal crew that I think did a good job. We had Jack Hamilton as provost, and Jack's a pretty straightforward, not screw around kind of guy. We had Eric Monday as a senior VP. On the athletic side, along with Joe, we had, obviously, Verge was there, and Eddie Nunez, and some really strong people who would stand and be counted, and that's what it takes.
Your association with Verge Osberry, he did work for you, after all. Was it positive?
Yeah. I thought Verge was a solid citizen. I don't know what's happened since or what's happened in the intervening years, but I always thought Verge was a guy that I could have a pretty direct conversation with, and mm-hmm. that he was in it for the right reasons. And I think this clearly the same was true with Eddie, who's now AD at the University of New Mexico. So all in all, I thought Joe had built a pretty solid team over there, and I thought we had a pretty solid team internal to the administration as well. And I had some good colleagues. I mean, one of the people I turned to often, if for another other reason was legal advice, was Jack Weiss, who was leading the law program at the time.
Yes.
So it helps a lot to surround yourself with people you have confidence in. I won't speak to anybody since I left, but I'll speak to those folks as very high-quality people.
In our visit with Scott Woodward, the LSU athletic director, late last month, he talked about Joe Oliva being in a spot that was not comfortable when Oliva suggested the firing of Les Miles. This was after you left. Mm-hmm. And Oliva, as AD, presumably had the power to do that. But Scott Woodward acknowledged that in 38 states, the football coach or basketball coach at a major state university is the highest paid public official. And quite often with the money goes power, and power, when people have it, they usually use it. And it's not usually a good idea for the AD to unilaterally make these kinds of decisions. Do we have an age now of the imperial coach in which some of these people are largely untouchable?
Oh, I think there's still some of that. I think the LSU example is a good one that has eroded some of that because people are watching more closely, and now, particularly with social media, so much can be reported instantaneously. But still, I think that there are obviously cases where the imperial coach can have enormous sway. I don't have any reason to doubt his integrity, but certainly Nick Saban's one of those people. Urban Meyer, you know, he's going to the pros now, but Urban could name his job. There are a bunch of them like that. And yet that's part of the trick of negotiating the institution in such a way that you can work either with or around. And then if you have to have a head-on collision, you got to have a head-on collision. But there's no question you can feel that power.
Well, Urban Meyer lost his gig at Ohio State after winning a national championship, and he'd won a couple of them at Florida, too, for essentially covering for an assistant coach who was involved in sexual misconduct. Now, in this case, it's a coach covering for a player, presumably, allegedly, and it's a coach who 30 years ago had restraining orders against him for repeated violations of sexual aggression or domestic violence against a woman in Miami. Is all of this relevant now, and could it bring down this particular coach based on where you're looking at it from Florida?
Well, I think so. I think so. I think we're so much more attuned to what's going on out there. And I hope institutions are constantly asking themselves across the board, what's our value system really? And at some point, you got to stand behind that value system. And then sometimes it comes with painful decisions or politically dangerous decisions, if nothing else. But, yeah, I think so. And I think we've seen that, you know, in the past, when you think about the Woody Hayes case, among others, right? And there's some cases where stepping over the line forced the hand, and it should force the hand, of those who have to make the decisions. But it also puts you in a tricky position. There's no question about that. And I appreciate the challenges everywhere that has big-time sports. We're a mid-major without football at Florida Gulf Coast University. And there are many days that I get up in the morning and say, thank God. Right? And I used to tease one of the coaches there, D.D. Bro, who I think was one of the superstar coaches at LSU. And I said, you know, D.D., I never worry about getting a call at 2 in the morning that the gymnastics team has been in a bar fight. I mean, if there's one comforting notion was that we had some teams that were so respected and so respectful, that they sort of offset the fear of the others?
Well, we men tend to get in bar fights, and we do things that are uncivilized. And if you look at most of the crimes in America, most of them are committed by men. And in this case, all of the allegations to this point, now some of the cover-ups involve women, allegedly, but the serious allegations that started everything involve men. And these young men who are athletic and they're in a competitive environment, and they're basically on campus to beat up people when they're playing football, they have aggression, and sometimes they get in trouble.
Well, and I don't think there's any question that many of these cases you go back and look at, they've been shielded from responsibility because of their athletic abilities before they get to college. In high school and along the way, they oftentimes are allowed to get away with conduct that the average student, male or female, but particularly male, wouldn't get away with.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're spending some more time with former LSU Chancellor Mike Martin, now president of Florida Gulf Coast University. He's had a long career in higher education, and if you'd like to visit with this fine man, 877-217-5757. And we also have some several emails, and I'll get to a few of them. Here's one from Jamie at LSU saying, were you surprised that King Alexander got in a situation that ultimately cost him his job at Oregon State based on his actions or lack thereof at LSU?
Well, I regret it for King. I don't know him well, and I don't know all the circumstances. And you probably know I spent 15 years at Oregon State, so I knew a bit about Oregon State. And so I'm never surprised these days that these jobs get truncated. A number of friends of mine who have, for one reason or another, stepped on a landmine, I always feel bad for them, but we all know now that it comes with the territory.
Well, King Alexander now may very well be radioactive in higher education, but it appears that if he had fired Les Miles here, he might have lost his job, and then ultimately he did lose his job at Oregon State, probably because he didn't fire Les Miles. So he was in a tough spot, and
no question about it. And I want to say I can't pass judgment on a decision he made. I wasn't there. But sometimes you got to decide where your integrity is, and as I say, that's all part of what happens in this business now. And the tenure of university presidents and chancellors has gotten very short over the years, and I think it's because of these kinds of events.
I don't know how closely you followed what's happening here, but there were allegations of sexual assault, and in Darius Geis, not only sexual assault, but also making crude suggestions to a 70-year-old security worker just trying to make a living at the Superdome. And here this young man is using profanity and propositioning her in the crudest of ways in front of other people. And the story today is that an emissary on her behalf, maybe without her knowledge, sought $100,000 or the suspension of Geis from the Citrus Bowl to get rid of this. And what do you make of all this right now?
Oh, I tell you, these get very complicated, don't they? And this is a case where, perhaps had someone come down on that player earlier, this could have all been avoided. We all have a few of them that we bump into who, for whatever set of reasons, background or just general character, step out of line and do harm to themselves, do harm to the program. And it's a complicated, I hope it gets sorted out for the sake of LSU. It's a great university, and as you and I have talked about this, Jim, the sports programs can cast a real warm glow on the place, and they can cast quite a negative pall. And in the process, people lose sight of the fact that there's some fabulous faculty there, some great staff. I had the great opportunity to interact with some wonderful students, and that gets lost in all of this. And that's, to me, one of the real seriously damaging parts of every one of these kinds of events.
Well, another listener, Tom on Blue Bonnet, asks about the supposed inordinate authority the LSU board exercises, and In King's case, he says basically the board hired the athletic director, a new one, and told him to fire Oliva without even consulting him. What do you think?
Well, that's one of those cases where you got to decide. I mean, one of the reasons I had good retreat language in my contract is that would have given me the opportunity to walk away from that one. I'm not going to judge King on this. I wasn't there, and I don't know all the circumstance. But you got to have the capacity to say, no, I'm not going to go along with it. And, on a couple of occasions, and I won't name them specifically, where a board member had tried to tell me to do something that I was not comfortable with, I said, well, I'd be more comfortable with it if you're willing to say that to me on the steps of the administration building in public. And it usually, or put it in writing if you don't mind. And because I didn't want to be put in a position where I had to knuckle under. And as I said before, you know, John Lombardi and I went way back to our Florida days, and John has his own challenges and personality quirks, but he was a pretty good buffer. You know, I could call him up and tell him I'm not going to put up with this, and he would say, stand where you are, and I'll help you out. So I had that advantage over some others.
What about that separation? You had a boss, the president, now we have a president/chancellor running LSU and every other thing that is LSU. Is that good?
You know, when I first took the job as chancellor, I thought the combined job would be more appropriate. But as I got to spend some time there, I began to really appreciate the separation. Because I do think there's a very different management of a system, because I did system at Colorado, over an individual campus. And there's always the concern that if you are both, you pay more attention to the one you're the chancellor of than the other sisters in the organization. So if I were to do it over again, I'd argue to go back to the split arrangement. And as I say, John and I had more than our share of differences of opinion, but that went way back to our Florida days. And we could walk away from them still having some faith in one another. And I think that helped me out during a couple of the stressful times.
Well, is the situation going to impede LSU's ability to have anyone of national stature pursue this job?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think, for one thing, I think all over the country, it's really a seller's market for leaders now as opposed to a buyer's market, because a lot of people are getting out, not only because of the pandemic, but other reasons, the politicization of these jobs. It's going to be a challenge. But as I've told some other folks, look, if I could be of any help at all, whatever, and I don't know what that is, but I'd recommend it to a good person, because I think deep down inside it's a very good university. And I think it's got some chances to be better yet. And that's always what I thought was the fascination of the place. But it's going to be harder. I think every one of these jobs is getting harder and harder to fill.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this shakes out, but who would have thought that 10 LSU officials would be called before a legislative committee?
Oh, man. You know, and rightfully so, I do believe that ultimate accountability comes to some extent in those kind of public forums. And that's the way it is in this world. And, you know, I go to Tallahassee and testify from time to time and appear before various formal and informal groups, because it comes with the territory at a public university.
Well, I have a few other inquiries from listeners. Matt, let's look at David. He says, here's a good question for Dr. Martin. Where does President Martin see higher ed in the next 25 years with ever-increasing college fees and viable online alternatives?
Well, I think for one thing, you're going to see greater and greater consolidation of institutions and exits. We're seeing a number of universities, smaller institutions, poorly endowed institutions, or states where population is dropping, and particularly among college-age students, beginning to close or at least merge universities. So I think there's going to be a continual shaking out, no question about that. I think we've learned in the pandemic that there's a way to blend a traditional education with online and actually make it better. And so I think you're going to see a new generation of faculty who are much more comfortable with that kind of a model. We're certainly learning it here. So there's some real changes in the wind. And I wish I were in some ways 20 years younger so I could be party to it. On the other hand, I'm pretty happy not to be 20 years younger so I don't have to be party to it.
Dr. Martin calls it as he sees it now. Another listener asks about Kirby Smith Hall is coming down,
where
I lived for a few years, and you once made perhaps the most memorable quote ever about Kirby Smith Hall.
Well, I said it was gave us a chance to feel what it was like to live in the Soviet Union, or something close to that. I thought it was a wonderful example of Soviet architecture. And students who had not lived through that era should have a chance to go over there and feel what it's like to be in this enormous piece of cement that had virtually no character at all. But in some respects, that was its character, right? I used to go over there and ride the elevator up to the seventh floor or something just to say, you know, this is like being in Moscow. I mean, it's very interesting. So it was very utilitarian and prominent. And the only thing I always thought is, if you're going to have a skyline for LSU, that one dominating the skyline always was a bit of an insult to the rest of the lovely skyline of LSU. But interesting place.
Well, you mentioned the Soviet Union. The American athletes who were at the Olympics a few years back when Russia was the host said that the murals at the hotel were of Vladimir Putin with his shirt off. Now
I didn't know. I missed that.
That'd keep you awake at night, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Well, if they're going to keep Kirby Smith open, I hope that there'll be a mural of you with your shirt off since you live there. I mean, I'd be willing to contribute heavily just to that that venture.
Let's not get carried away. But I lived in room 1108 for I think 5 semesters, so I got to know Kirby Smith pretty well. But the air conditioning was constantly going out, and I remember we would do it with the lights, and it would read too hot, because it was a brutally hot place when the air conditioning went out. But right now, the university itself is in somewhat of a predicament. LSU will certainly survive this, but there are going to be some bumps in the road. And how much is the nation following this? Is this just a hiccup for the rest of the country, or people really taking a close look at what's going on?
Well, I think people are taking a close look at what's going on. I mean, I think it's pretty prominent. And I think part of it is we're all a little bit feeling some of the same stresses, maybe not as a result of the athletic program, but the same stresses going on as the earlier question raised, that we're looking around at each other to see how we're reacting to it. So I don't think it's invisible to the folks out there, because it's being, you know, LSU is being covered in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, Inside Higher Education, all the stuff we read each day. So how it's navigated there will be a lesson to some others of us.
Well, Dr. Martin, thank you for your service to LSU, and we're glad you're still in the game, and we'll look forward to another conversation soon. It is always an honor and pleasure to catch up with you.
Thank you very much, Jim. Always a pleasure on my end as well. Please know that, and greet all my friends there.
Will do. Mike Martin, president at Florida Gulf Coast University and chancellor of Louisiana State University, 2008 to 2012. He left with an almost national championship. Remember 9-1-9-12, Alabama 21, LSU 0? Well, that was his swan song, but Les Miles had better days. We'll talk more when we return. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we switch gears and are joined by Dorothy Wickenden, accomplished writer. Dorothy is the author of Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West, and the editor of the New Republic Reader, 80 Years of Opinion and Debate. And she is back in a big way. Her latest work is The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. Good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning.
Well, the three people that you focus upon are fascinating people, and I suppose you had to make this choice, but how did you come to this trio?
Well, I actually came to this trio through my earlier book, Nothing Daunted. I was doing research on that because I had listened to my grandmother. That was about my grandmother and her best friend who grew up in upstate New York in by then it was a post-industrial town called Auburn. And I'd never been there. And she, in her oral history, she mentioned that her grandparents lived next door to the famous 19th century statesman William H. Seward. So I went to Auburn, basically just to check out this story, went to the Seward House Museum, got that confirmed, and then I was given a private tour of the museum. And the young education director, Jennifer Haynes, wanted to talk not about William H. Seward, but about his wife, whom she thought, correctly as it turned out, had been completely overlooked, almost completely overlooked by historians, who generally regarded her as Seward's first biographer put it, as a neurotic invalid. So she said that, well, you know, yes, she had health problems, but she was a force of nature. She took me down into the original basement kitchen where Frances Seward harbored freedom seekers on the Underground Railroad. And she said, you know, in Auburn at the time, she was a complete outlier, the only other woman in town who remotely shared her political beliefs. Mm-hmm. Was Martha Coffin Wright, the second agitator in my book, who lived around the corner, a Quaker mother of six, who was hated being housebound, wanted to break out of the traditional role of wife and mother. And the two of them began talking a lot about, and she too, Martha too, harbored, in fact, she, a decade earlier, she started harboring freedom seekers in her basement kitchen. So I was learning all this at the Seward House Museum, and I thought, well, these women sound pretty remarkable. And then I learned that Frances Seward, in 1859, sold a house and 7 acres to Harriet Tubman just a mile down the street. And I thought, well, that's a story about Harriet Tubman that maybe only people in Auburn really know about. We all had grown up with these incredible stories of her heroism on the Underground Railroad, but she was from the East, you know, she grew up in slavery on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. How did she end up, you know, getting to Auburn, mm-hmm. and buying a house as a fugitive slave from another woman? I mean, women didn't buy and sell property at that time, and they certainly didn't sell property to fugitive slaves. So I just thought, wow, this is really incredible. And I went down the street, and indeed, I saw the Tubman house, and there was a tiny museum there, and I got a tour of that little museum, which has now been taken over by the National Park Service. And
all right, well, yeah, your book extends over 40 years from the time when Harriet Tubman was enslaved to 2 decades after the Civil War. It was a radically changed United States, and Dorothy, how much of an impact did Harriet Tubman have on that change?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last.
As far as her influence in the change of the country during those 40 years that you cover.
Yes, well, and this was one of the things, as I began my research and got more deeply into it, and there has been excellent scholarship on Tubman in recent years. She, you know, her Underground Railroad exploits were only 10 years of her life. Incredibly important. She rescued her entire family and some, you know, 70 people on 12 expeditions back into the Eastern Shore. But then, she bought this house from Frances Seward. And then, when war broke out, she decided that she wanted to join the Union Army. So she was a very shrewd strategist, and she made all kinds of really important friends in Boston, among other places, with the senior most abolitionists. And she got in to see the governor of Massachusetts, convinced him that she could be valuable in Union-occupied Port Royal, South Carolina, was given permission to go down there. She worked on the Port Royal experiment, which was a social service organization that grew up to help the 10,000 enslaved people. But she also got herself known to the Union generals and made it clear that she could do something they could not. And she got money from them to hire some locals, 8 locals, to help her spy on the surrounding Confederate forces. And so she hired eight of these people. They helped her scout around the territory and helped the Union generals embark on a series of river raids in the region where the, you know, phalanxes of soldiers, who included the first black soldiers in the Civil War, went up these rivers, landed at plantation docks, burned down the plantations, and freed the enslaved people. Mm-hmm. And then inducted as many of the able-bodied men as they could into these new ranks of black soldiers. So Harriet Tubman was there and helped in incredibly important ways on the biggest raid of all on the Cumbie River.
Well, the agitators from our guest, Dorothy Wickenden. tells a story, as Hillary Clinton notes in her review, of America before the Civil War through the lives of three women. They all advocated for the abolition of slavery and women's rights as the country split apart. How courageous were they in this time to make these choices?
I'm sorry.
Well,
again,
how courageous were these three women?
They were quite different, but each astonishingly courageous in her own way. Tubman, most overtly so, since she was risking her life both in her Underground Railroad exploits and in her work with the Union Army. However, Frances Seward, who stayed, her husband was became senator, U.S. senator, and then the Secretary of State to Abraham Lincoln. He was in Washington. She hated Washington, which was a slave city where slavery was legal. She stayed in Auburn, and she conspired with Martha and their friend Harriet Tubman, whom they met with through a mutual contact. They conspired to basically overturn slavery. And the way Frances did it, it didn't seem as courageous, but she had grown up as an aristocrat. And she sided with the most benighted members of American society, who were enslaved people and women of all kinds. And so she launched her crusade through her husband. And they wrote letters, as I discovered, two or three times a week. And he was anti-slavery, but she was an outright abolitionist, and she pressed him throughout the war to be more radical. She was harboring slaves, she was giving money to people who were trying to buy the freedom of their families and so on. At the same time, Martha Coffin Wright broke out of her constricted, territory, which was the home. She was one of the organizers of the Seneca Falls Convention with her sister, Lucretia Mott, where she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass. They became very close friends of hers, and she associated with them to the horror of her neighbors, because she believed in complete racial equality and would often invite Frederick Douglass to her home. And they ended up calling her a very dangerous woman. And she began leading conventions for abolition and also for women's rights. So, again, we have to remember that at this time, this was incredibly radical. And women's rights crusaders were, if possible, even more reviled than abolitionists.
Well, thank you for your fine work. Our guest, Dorothy Wickenden, is a person of accomplishment. She's not only the author of Nothing Daunted and the Agitators, but has been the executive editor of The New Yorker since January of 1996. One reviewer says, like Doris Kearns Goodwin's team of rivals and David McCullough's John Adams, Dorothy Wickenden's The Agitators is revelatory, riveting, and profoundly relevant to our time. Thank you, Dorothy. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. And tomorrow on this show, we are slated to hear from Regina Barrow, the senator who is chair of the committee, the legislative panel that is reviewing the sexual misconduct allegations against LSU. And today, headline in The Advocate, Orgeron not likely to testify. Coach expected to send Senate panel a letter instead. And when my conversation with Senator Barrow yesterday, she said that was unacceptable. So we will see what happens in this collision of wills, and it should be interesting to say the least as far as how this plays out. But it is a time in which each day brings a new headline and seemingly new controversy, and the front page story of The Advocate today, requests for money change focus of LSU probe, recordings man sought $100,000 to keep Geis allegations quiet. This was a man, Cleavon Williams, who is accused of acting on behalf of Gloria Scott, the woman who was propositioned in crude ways by Darius Geis at the Superdome. And Gloria Scott was asking that Geis be withheld from the Citrus Bowl. That request was denied. And the university says it has recordings that indicate it, that Williams, perhaps acting by himself, Scott says he wasn't acting on her behalf, asked for $100,000. We'll talk about it. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.